Chapter 25. After dropping Janie McKenzie in Instow, Jen Rafferty made her way back to the police station. She tracked down the registered owner of the vehicle, which had blocked Janie in the afternoon before, and gave him a call. He was belligerent, blustering.
The council should have reserved parking for locals. All those people coming from outside, taking up our spaces, when we just want to take the kiddies to the beach. I didn't know I was doing any harm.
He had a Brummy accent, not so local himself, but it confirmed Janie's story. She hadn't driven into Barnstable the day before, not using her own car at least. Jen wanted to talk to the mother of Luke Wallace, the teenager who'd committed suicide in London, the lad whose death had forced Roger Pryor to resign from his high-profile post in Camden. She'd contacted the woman through the Love Luke Facebook page, and they'd arranged to talk on the phone. Matthew Venn was still out, and Jen used his office to take the call. This wasn't a conversation to be had with the noise of the open-plan room in the background. Detective Sergeant Rafferty. The woman sounded calm, normal. Jen wasn't sure what she'd been expecting. A nutter, perhaps, someone hysterical, or greedy, just desperate for compensation. Thanks for getting in touch. How can I help? Jen had planned how to approach the woman carefully. It wouldn't do to suggest that Roger Pryor was a killer, or even to link him to the investigation. Jen might not like the man, but she couldn't be the person to ruin his career without evidence. For one thing, Cynthia would never talk to her again, and Jen was already missing her support and friendship.
We had another suicide, much like Luke's, here on the North Devon coast. Our officers were involved. We want to prepare them for any possible future case. Perhaps put together a training package to help them deal better with people with severe depression. I hoped you might be able to help, to give the signs to look out for.
And all that, Jen thought, was true. She'd be prepared to put together a training module herself. She knew what depression felt like.
But that's brilliant!
Jen hadn't been expecting such an enthusiastic response and felt a little uncomfortable. The woman went on.
Of course, the police have to be at the front line when it comes to mental illness these days. The health service has been cut so much the police have to take up the slack.
You felt your son was let down by the NHS?
He was. I don't blame any individual, but there just wasn't anyone there when we most needed the support.
She paused. There were other influences. He'd found his way onto one of those foul suicide websites.
What are those?
Jen looked on Venn's desk for a pen to take notes. They were lined in a row next to a neat pile of scrap paper. Of course they were.
There are chat rooms where people come together to celebrate dying, to encourage members to take their own lives, Luke's mother said. That was how it seemed to us, at least, though they say they're just offering support.
Is there any way I could find out if the local young man who died here had accessed one of those?
I don't know.
The woman sounded uncertain. I can send you the link to the one Luke used. It was called Peace at Last. You might be able to trace the information through that. But the sites change and move, and they're not illegal.
I understand that the head of the trust resigned soon after your son's death.
He must have felt some responsibility.
He was forced to leave.
Now the woman's words were harsh and bitter.
And he moved almost straight into another cushy, well-paid post in a different part of the country.
There was no mention of where Pryor had taken up his new post. Perhaps she hadn't cared enough about the details to find out.
Has anyone else been in touch with you? Jen asked. We've been working closely with an organisation called Patients Together, and their senior officer, Dr. Nigel Yeo, was looking into the young man's death here.
Yes. Soon after Luke died, we had lots of inquiries, more than I could remember, but that was a recent one.
Was Nigel in touch by phone?
By email first, and then we had a phone call. I told him what I've just told you.
For the first time in the conversation, the woman sounded uncertain.
If you're working together, can't you just ask him?
He died, Jen said, very suddenly. That's one reason for my call.
There was silence.
Oh, the woman said. I'm so sorry. We only had that one conversation, but he seemed such a lovely, caring man.
Jen wandered back into the main office. There was still no sign of Venn, but Ross was there. Of all the team, he was the most tech-savvy,
She explained about the suicide forum and Luke Wallace. If we get hold of Mac's laptop, would we be able to tell what he'd been into?
You think that might be relevant?
Ross, as ever, seemed dismissive of any idea that wasn't his, or Joe Oldham's.
Yeah, I do.
What if Nigel Yeo had found out, in the course of his investigation, that Mac had been encouraged to kill himself on one of those sick sites? You told me Mac's psychiatrist said Yeo was furious the afternoon before he died. Discovering that Mac had been provoked to suicide might have made him even angrier than if he'd thought it was down to the hospital's negligence.
Jen thought for a moment.
According to Janie, Mac's suicide note said he was looking for peace at last. That's the name of the chat room Luke had accessed.
It could be a coincidence.
Yeah, it could, but it does fit with all the facts.
You believe Yeo might have traced this suicide site to someone local?
Jen could tell that Ross was more interested now. She thought if she wasn't careful, he'd claim the idea as his own.
I hadn't thought that far, but maybe.
It'd have to be some nut job, provoking a kid to kill himself. Can you think of anyone involved who might be that wacko?
Jen shook her head. She suspected Wesley might have looked at the site, not because he was suicidal, but because he'd always been curious about the strange and the perverse. He said it fed into his art. Wesley was dead too, though, and that didn't fit with the theory.
It'd be great if the tech guys could check Mac's laptop, if I can persuade the family to hand it over to us. Luke's mother sent me a link to the site he was using. Wouldn't it be interesting if Mac had accessed it too?
She paused.
Nigel Yeo had phoned Mrs. Wallace the week before he died.
One coincidence too many, do you think?
Ross was about to answer when Jen saw Joe Oldham approaching. The superintendent was a big man. Once he might have been fit. He was the leading light in the rugby club after all. Now he was flabby, with a florid face suggesting a heart attack about to happen. He could have retired months before, but Jen thought he liked the status, the power. He'd have nobody to bully at home.
Where's Ven?
The superintendent didn't hide his distaste.
At Westercombe, following up an inquiry with Mr. Lay?
Jen paused.
He'll be back in an hour for the briefing, if you'd like to join us.
Knowing Oldham was on his way out for his first drink of the evening, and that it was a compulsion he'd not be able to resist.
Nah, Oldham said. Don't want to interfere. Don't want it said I don't trust my team. Tell Ven to keep me updated.
He waddled away. His breathing was so poor that Jen almost felt sorry for him. Almost, but not quite, because he was a poisonous sod. She waited until he'd left the room before speaking again. I'll phone George McKenzie, see if he'll let us have Mac's laptop.
I've got a friend in tech, a wizard. You get it, I'll make sure he does it himself and fast-tracks it. We can sort out the budget later.
She smiled. She enjoyed these moments of collaboration with Ross, thought he might not be such a dick after all. She got out her phone to call McKenzie. By the time she'd finished, Ven was back and the meeting was about to start. Ven was unusually informal, with rolled-up shirt sleeves, no jacket. He looked flushed, as if he'd been in the sun. He stood at the front beside the large whiteboard, and as always, they quickly fell silent. Jen wished she had that authority.
It's been a busy day, he said, though I'm not sure how far we've got. More questions than answers, I think.
Ross, can you take minutes and get them out to the team as soon as possible? There's too much information to take in at a sitting. Ross nodded and got out his iPad. Throughout the briefing, Jen heard him tapping on the keyboard, a background rhythm to the conversation.
Shall I start?
As Ven leaned back against the desk, Jen saw that there were grass stains on his pale summer trousers. She was astonished. She'd never before seen him anything but immaculate. Ross and I met the team at the hospital this morning. Their head of comms was very much in charge, and she seemed more concerned about the hospital's image and providing any useful information. Mac's psychiatrist, Ratna Joshi, was more forthcoming when we saw her on her own, though, and implied that something had disturbed Yeo later that day.
Jen, could you go and see her tomorrow?
Jen nodded and Ven continued. Patients together, headed up by Yeo, seems to have been pretty dysfunctional. I had the impression he was easing out the dead wood. The woman in charge of finance had taken redundancy. and that Lauren was the only staff member he trusted.
"Sounds pretty ruthless," Ross said.
"Maybe. Or maybe he took his role seriously and wasn't prepared to tolerate hangers-on."
Matthew paused and looked around the room again to check that he had their attention.
"I had a quick visit to the woodyard. Lucy Braddock said Wesley was in the cafe on Sunday afternoon and waiting for someone who didn't turn up. He glanced around once more to make sure they all recognized Lucy's name. They did. Lucy was a hero to the team. Usually he met one of his middle-aged lady friends there, apparently. I'd like to get a handle on who those women were. Wesley might have confided in one of them."
A pause.
"Ross, that's for you."
"Start with Cynthia Pryor," Jen said.
"The magistrate?"
"Yeah, she was his biggest admirer. And of course, she's linked to the case because her husband's head of the trust, and Roger Pryor was in charge of the trust where Luke Wallace killed himself. An interesting coincidence."
"I met Pryor at this morning's meeting."
Ross paused.
"A cold fish.
Arctic," she said.
"Finally," Ven said, "I went to visit Frank Lay. While I was waiting for him, I found a shortcut to the main road between Barnstable and Instow. It goes through his garden and over a bit of common land. We can't assume that just because a Westercombe resident didn't pass through the checkpoint at the farmyard, they couldn't have killed Wesley Curnow." Jen thought Ven had finished and would ask her to take over, but he went on. "It seems that Lay has been the target of a hate campaign over one of his developments. I'm not sure how that can be relevant, but if his connection to the murders comes to light, it could be an excuse for the press to start thinking conspiracy theories and cover-ups. I'll check it out."
Now he did nod towards Jen to continue. She described her visit to the Mackenzies' house in Instow.
"They're much angrier about the way Mac was treated than I'd realised." She turned to Ven and again explained what she'd learned from her call to London. "Dr. Yeo had phoned her too, not long before he was killed. Ross and I wondered if Mac McKenzie had used the same site. In his suicide notes, he wrote that he was finding peace at last, and peace at last was the name of the group Luke had joined. We wondered if there might be a connection."
"There were almost 5 years between both deaths," Ven said. "It seems a little unlikely.
We don't know how many other suicides linked to the site there have been."
Ven considered for a moment.
"You think that Nigel Yeo had tracked down someone who was provoking these young people to kill themselves?"
He looked out at the room.
"Why would anyone want to do something like that?"
"Power," Jen said.
"Control?
Some strange form of art?"
She could imagine Wesley dabbling in the site, manipulating the members for his own amusement. But Wesley was dead.
Ven didn't answer and she continued.
"I think it's worth investigation, and George McKenzie has just given permission for us to take his son's laptop. Ross has a mate in IT who's willing to fast-track it."
"Let's give it a go then."
Jen couldn't tell what Ven was thinking, whether he was humouring them or if he thought it was really worth following up. The inspector paused for a beat.
"I want to know where Yeo was on Friday afternoon. We know he had a meeting in the hospital in the morning with Roger Pryor and his colleagues, and he was there again at close of play, but he seems to have gone AWOL for the rest of the day. Let's find out where he was and what he was doing."
They drifted away then, and Jen walked home, through the evening streets. People had spilled out of the pubs onto the Newport pavements. At home, her children were in their rooms, each on a screen, each preoccupied and scarcely responding when she looked in on them.
"How can I tell what they're looking at? Would I know if they were depressed? If some sick bastard was persuading them that suicide is a grand gesture? A final escape?"
Chapter 26. Mel was on an early shift, but Ross got up before her. He'd seen little of her since Nigel Yeo's murder, and he had an ill-defined, worrying sense that she was unhappy. When he'd got in the night before, she'd already eaten and was ready for bed, sitting in the living room in her nightie and the silk dressing gown he'd bought for her last birthday, watching television. There was cold meat and salad in the fridge, and she set it out for him and put a jacket potato in the microwave, but seemed reluctant to talk. When he joined her in bed, he tried to take her in his arms, but she turned away, tense and silent. Now he went to the kitchen while she was still asleep, before the alarm clock had woken him, made tea and brought it up to her. That's kind. She seemed more herself. He loved her like this, tousled, barefaced. She'd pulled herself into a sitting position and her nightdress had slipped over one shoulder. Is everything okay? He wanted to reach out and stroke the shoulder, but her coldness of the night before made him reluctant. He didn't know how he'd feel if she pushed him away.
Yeah, she said. Everything's fine. Sorry if I seemed a bit grumpy last night. It was a long day. One of my residents died. We were expecting it, but she'd been with us for years.
Oh, I'm sorry. But still he didn't touch her, and still he wasn't entirely reassured. Ross found Cynthia Pryor in the magistrate's court. He arrived just before the morning session ended for lunch and slipped in at the back. Cynthia was chair of the bench and Ross heard her sentence a young woman to probation for shoplifting. He knew the woman and the family she'd come from and thought she was bloody lucky not to have got at the very least a suspended prison term. He stood with the faded solicitor and the scattering of the defendant's relatives as the magistrates left the court, then went to wait in the lobby. Cynthia Pryor emerged on her own. She was wearing an orange linen dress and carried a big straw bag. She recognised him immediately and wasn't pleased to see him.
Detective Constable May, do you have a case this afternoon? I thought it was just traffic for the rest of the day.
I was hoping to talk to you.
The lobby had cleared of people now, and a shaft of sunlight caught motes of dust.
About Wesley Curnow.
Ah, poor Wesley. I'll miss him so much.
She turned away from him, perhaps to hide her distress, and continued to walk to the entrance.
I was just going to lunch. I don't have a lot of time. If you must ask your questions, why don't you join me?
He followed her around the corner of the street and into a little tea shop where she was clearly well known. A small table furthest away from the window had a reserved sign on it, and she sat there. When the waitress came, she ordered smoked salmon sandwiches and Earl Grey tea without looking at the menu. Ross was hungry, but he wasn't sure about the etiquette of eating with a potential suspect, who was also a member of the magistracy. In the end, he went for coffee and a tea cake. He couldn't see a tea cake as proper food.
Wesley was a good friend, Cynthia said, once the waitress had left them. What would you like to know?
When did you last see him?
The Friday night of my party. He was one of the last to leave. I did speak to him, though, on the Sunday that he died. He phoned me in the morning, obviously upset about Nigel's murder. He asked if we could meet up.
The waitress arrived with a tray, then had to return with cutlery. She was elderly and slow, and Ross struggled to contain his impatience.
Did you agree to see him?
Cynthia cut her sandwich into smaller pieces.
No, of course I wanted to. I could tell how upset Wesley was, but Sunday's our family time. Inviolable. And my husband's not finding things easy either at the moment. You'll know all about Nigel's witch hunt. I didn't feel I could desert him. So I cooked a proper lunch, which we ate mid-afternoon, and we opened a bottle of good wine, and then another, and that was our Sunday.
Why did you invite Nigel to your party and arrange for him to meet Sergeant Rafferty if you thought his investigation was a witch hunt?
She shrugged. I wasn't sure why exactly Nigel wanted to meet Jen. If he'd seriously thought Roger and his team had committed a crime, he'd have made a more formal approach.
What did your husband make of your relationship with Mr. Curnow? Ross knew he would never be able to cope with Mel hanging out with another bloke. Trips to London, meals in restaurants, where all their friends could see what was going on, making a tit of him.
Oh my God, it wasn't that sort of relationship.
Cynthia gave a choking burst of laughter.
I didn't fancy him. I didn't even like him that much. It was a friendship of convenience. I don't enjoy going to the theatre or to exhibitions on my own. What's the fun in that? And he did know about art. He could be entertaining too if he set his mind to it. Roger was just glad he didn't have to turn out unless it was really something he enjoyed.
What about Wesley's other lady friends? Ross asked. Did they have friendships of convenience too?
Oh, I think some of them imagined they were in love with him. He could be charming, and he had a way of making them feel special. in return for a free meal and a few glasses of wine. He had rather expensive tastes in booze, but it would have taken a very classy offer, a Scottish castle or a New York apartment, to persuade him to give up his freedom. He was genuinely a free spirit, and he did love his art and his music.
Would he have called one of his other women on Sunday morning, do you think, as you were unavailable?
He might have called Eve. They might not have been close friends, but they respected each other's work. Really, he saw the other older women he hung out with just as meal tickets.
What about Janie Mackenzie?
She gave another little laugh. I think Wes was finally coming to realise that Janie was a bit beyond him.
She went with him to your party.
She did, but she made it quite clear all night that she was bored out of her skull. Wesley's closer to her parents in age, and I think she saw him as a family friend, a kind of quite hip uncle, rather than a potential partner.
Cynthia looked at her watch.
I'm sorry, but I really should get back to the court. Did Wesley ever discuss Alexander Mackenzie's death with you? Wes was a friend of the family, and he lived and worked with Eve at Westercombe. He must have been curious.
Cynthia got to her feet. She'd already paid for the bill, for his share as well as her own, which had made Ross feel uncomfortable, as if he was playing the role that Wesley once had, of kept companion. He thought Matthew Venn would never have allowed himself to be put in this position. She stopped, poised by the table for a moment.
Wesley didn't really do curiosity, not about things like that. He really only cared about himself, his own interest, and his own comfort.
She pulled her bag onto her arm.
Perhaps we're all like that when you come down to it. But some of us are better at hiding our selfishness than others.
Chapter 27. Jen tracked down Ratna Joshi to the psychiatric unit in the grounds of the General Hospital, where Matthew and Ross had spoken to her the day before. When she finally got through on the phone, after forcing her way through a series of receptionists and a medical secretary, the doctor sounded busy, distracted.
Is this really necessary? I talked to your colleagues yesterday.
More information has come to light, Jen said. I do need your help.
I'm on a long shift today. I won't be free until 8 this evening.
Why don't I come to you?
Jen could sense Joshy dreaming up excuses and continued before she could speak.
I'll be there at 10.
Gorse Hill, where Mac had been treated, was a modern building not far from the main hospital building. It was run by the same trust. Jen wasn't sure what she'd been expecting. Locked doors, mad people howling at the sky. Instead, it could have been any health centre in the country. There was the same wide entrance with the trust's logo on a sign outside, the same reminder about parking charges. Outside, a group of men in tracksuit bottoms and t-shirts stood smoking. They ignored her as she walked in. Ratna Joshi came to reception to collect her, and they walked together along a corridor to her office, past a nurse's station where a woman in her 30s was in tears, apparently inconsolable. As they passed, grief seemed to turn to rage, and the patient started yelling at the staff, her words incomprehensible. Ratna approached her and put her arms around her.
Hey, Lizzie, take it easy. We'll get you home soon, I promise, but you're not quite ready yet. Let's get you back to your room.
The woman sobbed into the young doctor's shoulder, and Ratna held her until she grew calm. At last the patient pulled away and looked around her, blank-faced, suddenly completely unemotional. She walked off, straight-backed down the corridor away from them without another word.
What was wrong with her?
Jen had found the encounter, the transformation, shocking. She didn't expect an answer, but as the doctor stopped to unlock her office, she responded,
Postnatal psychosis. She was so unwell that she threatened to stab her 2-month-old baby. We had to admit her for her own and the baby's safety. She has a toddler at home too.
She stood aside to let Jen in.
We have a limited number of beds and community care is stretched. Those are the decisions we have to make every day. Do I admit Lizzie or a young man with severe depression and a family to support him?
She nodded for Jen to take a chair.
I assume you are here about Alexander Mackenzie and Nigel Yeo.
I am.
Jen tried to order her thoughts, still shaken.
But not to criticise. I don't know how you do this. People think police officers have it tough.
but I wouldn't be in your shoes for a day.
I'm going to make coffee, Ratner said. Only instant, but better than nothing. Would you like one?
Sure.
Someone walked down the corridor outside, singing. The noise was loud, tuneful and joyous. Patient or carer? Did it matter? Somehow, Jen thought, within these walls, it felt as if they were all in it together. All maybe a little bit crazy, and a lot under pressure.
So what was so urgent? Ratner asked.
Nigel had been in touch with the mother of another young guy, Luke Wallace, who committed suicide. Mrs. Wallace was convinced that her son was failed by the medical staff who should have been caring for him. He lived in Camden, and at the time the trust was managed by Roger Pryor. A pause. Mr. Pryor was the subject of a social media hate campaign and vilified in the local press there. Ratner was listening. Jen supposed a psychiatrist would have to be good at that, but she said nothing. Jen went on. I spoke to the woman too. She had told Nigel that her son had accessed a website that encouraged patients to kill themselves. I wondered if Mac had admitted to doing that too. If he had, it might explain Nigel's anger when you saw him on the evening before his body was found. Perhaps his fury wasn't directed at you and the trust, but at the people behind the website.
You believe that was why Nigel Yeo was killed? Because he'd discovered the identity of the individual who persuaded Alexander Mackenzie to jump into the sea that day?
I believe it's one explanation.
Jen took a sip of the coffee.
What do you think? Might it be feasible? Could Mac have been using a site like that?
Silence. Ratner was frowning, thinking. Nothing she did was hasty or ill-judged. The office looked out onto a courtyard with a square of green space in the middle. A group of women sat on the grass, chatting. An older woman with a lanyard and a pass seemed to be leading the conversation. Some sort of group therapy session? Jen couldn't hear the words, but was fascinated all the same. She was glad that Ratner was taking time to consider the question seriously.
He might have done, but I'm not sure if any of us would have known if he'd been getting those kinds of messages through a group on the internet. If he was determined to kill himself, he'd have lied, pretended, made up the stories he thought we'd want to hear so we'd discharge him, or let him discharge himself.
She paused.
I was taken in. I honestly didn't think he was so sick. He was severely depressed, but he told me he wasn't having suicidal thoughts. He was lying, and I should have pressed him.
He could have done that, pretended he was less ill than he really was.
This time the answer came more quickly.
Sure. He could have created a narrative in his head that we were the bad people, the people who were trying to stop him finding peace or rest, or whatever he'd been persuaded by the group that death would bring for him. If he'd bought into that story, he'd see it as his mission to mislead.
Jen tried to process that.
Why would anybody do that? Get other people to kill themselves?
Not all the websites are persuasive. Some are there genuinely to give support to people with suicidal thoughts, to take the ideas seriously and not to judge. Others might be more dangerous. They could attract people who are very sick themselves and see it as a God-given mission to help sufferers into another world. A messiah complex isn't unusual in psychosis.
She nodded towards the door and gave a little smile.
Any number of my patients think they're Jesus. Some might join because they're teetering on the edge of suicide and hope the group will help them find the courage and the means.
Ratner paused for a moment.
I suppose there might be occasional individuals who get off on the power over life and death, who aren't ill in the sense that we understand the word, who are just there to provoke another person's death.
Jen felt winded, as if she'd been punched in the gut. If you could target a vulnerable individual in that way, wouldn't it be murder? An almost perfect murder.
That would be evil.
Yes, the doctor said. Truly evil. But not, I understand, against the law.
Have you come across any patients who have admitted to using one of the suicide forums?
Ratner shook her head.
But I probably wouldn't. As I said, if someone's that serious about killing themselves, they're not going to discuss it with one of us. We'd be seen as restrictive, part of the conspiracy preventing them from having the freedom to make their own choices.
Did Mac have any special friends while he was here?
any of the staff members he was particularly close to. He was only here for one night before he died, so there was no real chance for him to make friends. And it's hard for severely depressed people to connect with other individuals, especially if they're ill too.
Jen remembered Mac as Janie had described him. The restless pacing, the incomprehensible muttering, the isolation in a world of his own. She'd called Mac self-obsessed too. Of course, real friendship with another person would be impossible for someone that ill. If Mac had turned to the internet suicide forums with their wild ideas, that would give an impression of community, permission to be entirely selfish. He could take in the comments and the encouragement without needing to give anything in return.
Was there a staff member he connected to? Jen asked the question without expecting any positive response, and Ratner shook her head.
This is an acute hospital. Most patients aren't here for long enough to form useful relationships. We're stretched, impossibly stretched.
One last question, Jen said. She was starting to sense Ratner's impatience.
When you saw Nigel Yeo on Friday as you were leaving for the day, did he give you any idea where he'd spent the earlier part of the afternoon?
The doctor shook her head.
No idea at all.
Jen's car had been parked in full sunlight, and she got the aircon blasting as she got in. She sat for a moment before deciding to drive to the coast and to the Mackenzies. She couldn't think why they might want to hide Mac's laptop or computer or delete his browsing history, but she didn't want to take any chances.
Martha was just where Jen had seen her on the previous visit, standing on the balcony, looking out at the beach, cigarette in hand. She waved at Jen.
You're becoming a regular.
Her tone was ambiguous. It didn't make Jen feel that she was welcome.
I'm sorry to disturb you again. I'm hoping you might be able to help me. George and Janie are working. They're both busy, and I wouldn't want to call them home.
Again, the actress managed to give the impression that Jen was intruding.
But I'll see what I can do. Just wait there and I'll let you in.
Once more, Jen was led into the sunlit kitchen, but this time the place was tidy, almost sterile. It was hard to imagine the family together here, eating a late breakfast, as they'd been when she'd visited on Sunday. The found objects on the yellow shelf seemed out of place, relics of former days. Martha sat at the table. There was no offer of coffee.
What is it?
Before he was killed, Nigel Yeo spoke to a mother whose son also died from suicide. We have no exact record of the call, but they discussed a website chat room where people considering suicide were given tips and encouragement to carry it out. Do you know if Alexander visited a similar site?
Martha shook her head.
By the end, he'd stopped talking to us, to his father and me. At least, he stopped making any sense.
She was no friendlier, but she looked broken, exhausted, no longer the glamorous actress performing for an audience.
He did have access to a computer, a smartphone.
Of course, we all do now, don't we?
Again, it was hard to tell whether the weariness was real or manufactured.
Do you still have his devices?
Martha looked up.
Not his phone. That was lost when he drowned. He always carried it in his jeans pocket. He was always losing the bloody thing, or sitting on it.
His laptop?
That's in his room.
Would you mind if I took it away with me?
There was a pause.
And that would help your investigation how?
It's a theory, Jen said.
If someone Mac knew was part of the suicide chat room and encouraged him to take his own life, and then Nigel found out, that could be a motive for murder.
But my son didn't have any suicidal friends. Everyone he'd gone to school with was upbeat.
Her voice turned hard and was tinged with envy.
Normal.
Jen remembered Ratner's theory about a participant in the group being turned on by the power over life and death.
Perhaps one of his friends was curious?
She hesitated.
Or evil?
You think someone might have encouraged Mac to take his own life for fun?
The woman looked physically sick.
As I said, it's just a theory.
Of course, take his laptop. It's in his room. The small room at the front on the second floor at the top of the stairs.
She looked at Jen.
Do you mind getting it?
I haven't gone in there since he died.
George said we should clear his stuff, move on. But I can't bear the thought of it. She paused again. I slept in his old rugby shirt for the first week after he went missing. I thought it smelled of him. Of course. At the door, Jen looked back at her. Would you mind if I had a quick look through his things? I won't take anything without your permission. Martha stared at her, and Jen thought the woman would refuse. Of course, she said at last. He was a very private person. None of us was allowed up there. I suppose it's not going to bother him now. After the first floor, the stairs narrowed. There were two rooms on the top floor, a bathroom and a bedroom. As Martha had said, the bedroom looked down over the beach. There was also a view of the balcony beneath, and on it, Jen saw an overflowing ashtray beside an old-fashioned striped deck chair. She thought Martha must spend most of her days there, separate from the world, reminded of her glory days, whenever passers-by recognized her. It was a sort of stage. The bedroom was neater than Jen had expected, certainly neater than her children's rooms, even Ella's, and her daughter was a tidy soul. There was a double bed under the window with a purple duvet cover, a couple of white wood cupboards containing folded clothes, a desk and an angle-poised lamp against one wall. On the desk, a laptop, still plugged in. It was hard to believe that someone with the chaotic mind and racing thoughts described by Ratner would keep his room so ordered. But perhaps he needed that. Perhaps he needed this clear space when he was contemplating taking his own life. The decision would be spiritual, almost religious. Perhaps if he was so convinced that it was the right thing for him, he hadn't needed any encouragement, and it was a decision he'd taken in a moment of clarity and reason. Jen unplugged the computer and put it in her bag. She walked down the stairs and paused at the kitchen door. Martha was still sitting there, her face set, apparently lost in thought. I've got the PC, Jen said. I've not taken anything else. Was Mac always that tidy? Yes, Martha said. It was one of his obsessions. She looked up. I hope you get to the bottom of it. All of it. At the moment, we're stuck as a family in the roles we had before our son died. George is still playing the jovial mine host. Janie is still the perpetual student with a holiday job, while she should be thinking of a proper career. And I'm still the actress waiting for a new role. We go round and round as if we're on a giant carousel. We can't move on. Chapter 28. As he drove inland towards the moor and Spennacott, the village where Frank lay was considered an enemy, Matthew Venn felt like a wicked schoolboy bunking off school. As a child, he would never have done such a thing, and might even have reported other kids who were behaving so badly. He'd been too scared of the world to be a rule breaker. But today he could understand the joy, the freedom of running away from everyday responsibility. The guilt, which was a backdrop to his life, added spice to the feeling of escape, the sense that he was on the verge of adventure. This was the place that Nigel Yeo had visited in the week that he was murdered, but Matthew couldn't really justify the expedition. He could have sent one of his team, or talked on the phone to the leader of the campaign to keep the care home open. Spennacott was in a valley bottom. Beyond it, the hills began to rise into Exmoor, and the heat haze. It wasn't very far from the farm where Jonathan had lived with his adoptive parents. At first sight, the village was unprepossessing, just one road with a narrow pavement on each side and a line of grey houses. There was nothing obvious here to attract tourists. No thatched cottages with roses round the door, no easy, picturesque footpath leading to the moors. The village centre was more appealing. A slow river was crossed by an ancient stone bridge, and the garden of the pub led down to the bank. But Matthew could see why the place had needed Leigh's help to bring people in. Although it was too early for lunch, the pub car park was more than half full, and a sign outside said it sold artisan coffee. One of the outbuildings had been turned into a shop and post office, and there was a queue leading into the street. A woman came out with a basket of fresh vegetables, carrots with the green frond still attached,
courgettes and loose ripe tomatoes, and climbed into a new 4x4. Then went into the building and ordered coffee at the bar. "I'm looking for the old people's home. Do you know where I can find it?"
"The Mount? Past the school and then take the track on your right. It's a bit overgrown. You might miss it."
The voice was local, so Frank Lay had provided this man, at least, with a job. His was the only North Devon accent Ven heard when he was drinking his coffee, and Ven was the youngest customer. The others were older, early retirees on holiday, or second homers escaping the city. But after all, what was wrong with that, Matthew thought. He was lucky to have been born here. Why shouldn't other people enjoy the place and sustain the communities which might otherwise die? Still, he understood the permanent residents' feeling that they'd been invaded and that a traditional way of life was under attack. Perhaps Jonathan had been right about the dangers of rural gentrification. Matthew had decided to visit the care home before talking to Paul Reed, the writer leading the campaign against its closure. It would be good to understand what had led the man to such a violent reaction. He went back to the car and crossed the bridge. It was playtime in the school on the opposite bank, and through the open windows he heard children's laughter. The overgrown track led up a slight rise through woodland. Earlier in the year there would have been a pool of bluebells, and some of the dying blossoms remained under the trees. The drive ended in a gravel parking circle by the side of a large Victorian house, all gables and chimney pots. At the front of the building there was a paved terrace where six elderly people were gathered with a carer in a blue uniform. Two of the residents were in wheelchairs, and all wore white cotton hats to protect them from the sun. Now that he was here, Ven wasn't sure what to do. He'd thought just to see the place, but his car had been noticed, and he didn't feel he could just drive away. He got out and walked towards the group.
"Hello, my dear."
The woman in the wheelchair waved and shouted across at him.
"What's a handsome fellow like you doing here?"
He was still a little way from the terrace, taking a shortcut across overgrown grass, so he didn't feel the need to answer. Through open French windows leading onto the terrace, he saw a shabby lounge with a threadbare rug over scratched wooden floors and sagging armchairs. It would be hard to lever a frail elderly person out of one of those. There was the sound of a hoover from deep in the house. The carer got to her feet to greet him.
"If you're considering the Mount as a home for a relative, I'm afraid we're not taking any more residents just now."
"They're trying to close us down," the woman in the wheelchair said. "But we're not bloody having it."
"This is Viv Reed."
The carer was laughing. He thought she probably laughed a lot. "She's the Mount's shop steward."
"Used to be a Labour councillor," Viv said. "And there weren't so many of those around here. I'm still keeping up the fight, along with my son Paul."
"He's leading the campaign against the closure."
"He is."
She sounded inordinately proud.
"Won't do no good, though."
The speaker was a little shriveled man.
"That Francis Lay will do just what he likes. Folks think he's a saint, but it's all about money with him."
Ven thought that Steph Bull in the Patients Together office had said exactly the same about Nigel Yeo. He wondered if he'd got both men wrong. Had they somehow generated their own propaganda, cultivated the image of being good and generous men, while being as selfish as everyone else? "I'm not looking for a place for a relative," he said. "I'm a detective investigating the murder of Dr. Nigel Yeo. I understand he came here last week. He was looking into the closure of the Mount."
"We heard that he was dead," Viv said. "We thought, that's it, our last hope gone."
"You had the impression that he was supporting your cause."
"He came for tea," Viv said. "He saw how happy we all were."
Matthew thought that didn't quite answer the question. Before he could say anything more, the carer joined in the conversation. "The doctor talked about his wife," she said. "The early onset Alzheimer's. He said that he'd been lucky enough to be able to care for her at home, and that she'd lived a full life, even when she was very ill. He said that everyone should have that right." A pause. "Unfortunately, we don't have facilities to look after patients with severe dementia here. We couldn't cope. I wonder if that might have influenced his impression of the home."
There was a silence, broken by the call of wood pigeons in the trees in front of the house. Ven turned back to Viv. Was your son here when Dr. Yeo visited?
Of course he was here. He'd invited the doctor to visit.
Did the doctor come back the following day? The Friday afternoon, perhaps for another look? We're trying to trace his movements on that day. The carer shook her head. Ven left them then and walked back to the car. He wondered again what he would do if ever his mother couldn't manage on her own. He was the only child, and the responsibility would lie with him. Wouldn't she be happier here, with the laughing carers and friendly residents, than in a clinical building with easily cleaned floors and specialist equipment? Perhaps she would, until the winter came and the roof started leaking and the bedrooms were cold at night. In the sunshine, it was easy to be romantic about such things. And besides, his mother had never been sociable, even when she was young. Reed's house was beyond the school, with a view of the river. It was a rather ugly villa, almost suburban, out of place in the rural setting. Ven had made an appointment, and the man was waiting for him. He was unprepossessing too, a grey man in his 50s with strange hairy growths on his face, giving him the appearance of a weasel. His voice was educated, pedantic. It was hard to believe that the joyous Viv had given birth to him. This was clearly not a family home. There was no sign of children or a partner. The door opened onto a corridor, stacked on one side with bundles of newspapers and cardboard boxes, everything dusty. There was brown lino on the floor. Reed let him through to the back of the house to what must have been intended as a dining room, but which was now a large, cluttered office. There was a view over an unkempt garden and the river. The window faced north, and the place was still dark. Bit of an overreaction, isn't it? Sending a detective all the way from Barnstable. As far as I know, I haven't broken the law. As always, it seems to be one law for the rich and another for the rest of us. Francis Lay makes a complaint, and I'm under investigation. He ruins the lives of a dozen elderly people, and nothing happens. Mr. Lay hasn't made a complaint of any sort. I'm investigating the murder of Dr. Nigel Yeo. We're tracing his movements for the last week of his life. You did meet him on Thursday afternoon.
Oh.
Reed sounded deflated. It seemed he'd worked himself up for a battle only to be disappointed.
Yes.
Can you explain how Dr. Yeo came to be involved with your campaign? Ven paused. I've been looking at the press you've generated. Very impressive. An article in The Observer. Even, I understand, a question in the House.
That was all very well, Reed said, but our publicity seemed to have little impact on Francis Lay. He was still determined to go ahead with the closure. I thought if I could get a group like Patients Together on board, someone official, Lay might start to take us seriously.
This seems very personal, Ven said.
Of course it's personal. It's about my mother's future.
I visited the Mount before coming here. Your mother seems remarkably adaptable. I'm sure she'd settle perfectly well in another home. Ven paused for a moment. I wondered if you had another reason for taking on Mr. Lay.
The decision to close the Mount was a final straw, Reed said. He owns this village like some sort of feudal lord. We're not in the Middle Ages.
Ven thought that still didn't quite explain the antipathy.
You're a writer.
Yes. Reed looked at Ven with suspicion. A travel writer and essayist. I freelance for the press and have had a couple of books published by mainstream houses. Not huge commercial successes, but well reviewed, and the most recent won a rather prestigious award. Ven wasn't quite sure where this was going.
In one of my articles for a Sunday paper, I explored the ethics of a wealthy man buying up a village, changing its character, excluding local people. Of course, Lay took exception to the piece. His lawyers claimed there were inaccuracies and threatened to sue. I would never have been able to fund a court case, so I was forced to make an apology.
He paused.
It was humiliating.
In those three words, Ven thought, lay the background to the campaign to keep open the Mount. Reed needed to show that he'd been right all along, that he was a downtrodden purveyor of truth, that Lay was a fat cat, who cared nothing for the people of the village.
What did Dr. Yeo make of the Mount?
Matthew asked. Did he support your view?
I don't know.
Reed turned away.
I expect he wouldn't have had the guts to stand up to Lay. The man's all-powerful and he seems to have everyone in his pocket. Planners, politicians, councillors.
This was starting to sound like paranoia. Ven imagined Reed on his own in here in the dark and dusty house, becoming obsessed with Lay, his wealth and his power, brooding, jealous, resentful.
Dr. Yeo didn't feed back his impressions to you.
No.
Reed was still bitter. He was pleasant enough when we were shown around the Mount. He engaged with the residents. He said he'd call in to see me here the following afternoon to give me his response.
Ven thought that seemed beyond the call of duty. Perhaps Yeo had felt some sympathy for this sad, lonely little man and had wanted to let him down gently. What happened?
Nothing. I got a phone call on Friday cancelling the visit. Yeo was very apologetic, apparently, and very melodramatic. A matter of life and death, he said, which was obviously an excuse.
Ven could sense the conspiracy theories swirling around in the man's mind and moved towards the door.
Dr. Yeo didn't go into any more details about why he had to cancel his meeting with you.
No, Reed said.
Yeo had gone through the motions, but clearly he wasn't prepared to waste his time any further on me.
Ven thought there was more to it than that. Something had happened after Yo's meeting in the hospital with Pryor, Radley and Joshi to make him decide not to make the trip out to Spennacott. Something which might have led to his death.
Ven drove back across the bridge and parked by the pub. It was full now with people who'd come to take lunch. They were spilling out into the garden with their drinks. He phoned Lauren Miller.
Just a quick query. Nigel went to Spennacott to investigate a complaint about an old people's home. Was that normally something he'd get involved in?
No, she said. But the whole case was so high profile and the relationships had become so fraught, so venomous, that he thought a visit might take the heat out of the situation. Reed had made a formal complaint on behalf of the whole community.
And of course, Nigel couldn't be seen to be siding with Lay, who was his daughter's landlord and benefactor, without taking the matter seriously.
Well, Lauren said, maybe there was something like that going on too.
Ven thought she sounded faintly amused. What was the outcome of the visit?
Oh, he thought Frank's judgment had been perfectly sound. The home needed so much work to bring it up to scratch that the residents' lives would have been disrupted even more than if they'd been forced to move to another local facility. He was hoping to mediate, perhaps to persuade Frank to offer compensation to the residents to make up for the inconvenience. That way it might be possible to bring about some reconciliation.
I see. Matthew thought Reed would just see an offer like that as a form of bribery, but worded properly, he might view it as a victory.
When did you discuss this?
We met up on Thursday evening, Lauren said. He was planning to visit Paul Reed, the activist behind the campaign, the following afternoon to sound him out. He thought Francis would agree to anything that would speed up the process of converting the place into a hotel, but he wanted Reed's agreement at least to consider the offer first.
But he never went, Ven said, almost to himself. Something happened and he had to cancel.
You really have no idea what that might have been.
I'm sorry, Inspector, I don't.
Ven was about to drive off when he saw that there'd been a voicemail from Jen. She must have called while he was talking to Lauren. Her voice was urgent, a little breathless.
I've picked up Mac's laptop and Ross will get it to his techie mate. Roger Pryor just phoned for you. He'd like to talk to you. He said he's working from home this afternoon, if that would be convenient.
Oh yes, that would be very convenient.
Matthew looked back at the pub's customers sitting in the sun, waiting for their meals, and felt only a brief moment of envy.
Chapter 29 The Pryor's house was very close to Nigel Yeo's in geography, but grander, larger. Ven thought the couple must rattle around in it. According to Jen, they'd never had kids. But then he supposed that selling a house in North London would have given them enough cash to go for something palatial. Roger Pryor led him into an office just off the hall. He seemed uneasy, pale, his skin almost white against the dark, rather oily hair. Ven could understand his discomfort. If the man had been hounded by the media previously over the suicide of Luke Wallace, he'd be anxious about being linked to another controversial case, this time to a double murder. The office was functional, but strangely old-fashioned. It seemed designed to give the impression of a library in a country house. One wall was lined with books, and there was a low leather Chesterfield against another. An impressive desk and chair stood under the window. Ven wondered if the room was supposed to intimidate, but then Pryor wouldn't often see colleagues here. Perhaps the man needed reassurance about his own status. "How can I help you?" Matthew waited for a moment. "Or perhaps you think you can help me?"
"No, nothing like that."
The man paused, and Matthew saw now that it wasn't anxiety that was causing the pale face, the tremor, but rage. Roger Pryor was one of those men who simmer, feed their resentment in the privacy of their own minds, and then blow up. "One of your officers went to see my wife this morning, in court." He did. Pryor might be hovering on the verge of losing control, but Ven felt very much in command of the interview, confident. "I asked DC Ross to talk to her."
"That seems like an intolerable intrusion, Inspector. I'd like to know how you can justify it."
Mrs. Pryor was the close friend of a murder victim, of two murder victims. That makes her a very useful witness.
"It would perhaps have been polite to make an appointment, not to appear suddenly at her place of work."
Pryor was struggling to keep calm now. Ven could sense the tension like a smell. The man's voice was shrill, fraying at the edges. "Two men have been murdered, stabbed and left to bleed. I think we've moved beyond a need for politeness." Ven kept his voice deliberately calm. Until now they'd been standing, with Pryor in front of the desk. Matthew took a seat on the Chesterfield. "Now I'm here, I have some questions for you. Why don't you take a seat? This might take a little while." Again, he thought Pryor might explode. It hadn't been a conscious tactic to provoke the man, but Matthew wondered now if he'd been hoping for such an outburst since entering the room. Had he taken the lead in the man's house, given him orders, just to goad him to a response? It wasn't his usual way to conduct an interview, but he wasn't often called on to interrogate entitled and wealthy men. For a moment, he thought Pryor would demand that he leave. He stood very still, his eyes wide and staring. But instead, the man walked round the desk and sat. "You were involved in an inquiry into a young man's suicide in your former post." Ven's voice was low, conversational.
"I was cleared of all responsibility."
"I think it was suggested that you resign, which isn't quite the same thing." Ven paused for a moment. "But the details aren't really important, are they? The point is that, having settled into a new place and with a new role, the last thing you'd want would be more adverse publicity."
"It was a dreadful coincidence. I felt as if I was being haunted by my past, that the circumstances of the previous inquiry were following me and there was no escape."
He looked directly at Ven.
"I still have nightmares about that time."
Ven was going to say that he imagined the dead boys' families still had nightmares too, but he restrained himself. He thought now that Pryor wasn't just on the edge of fury, but on the edge of a breakdown, and he didn't want that on his conscience. "Nigel Yeo had found out about the Luke Wallace case." Matthew made his voice friendlier, more sympathetic.
"Oh yes, Nigel was extremely thorough."
From Pryor's mouth, the word didn't sound like a compliment. "He brought it up at the meeting you had on the Friday, before his body was found."
"We'd discussed it a number of times before that. I think I'd convinced him that the connection was coincidental, except in public relations terms."
Pryor half stood in his chair.
"You have to understand, Inspector, that I had no reason to kill Nigel Yeo. He was doing his job and I was doing mine. We'd come to an understanding about changes to the Trust's procedures about supporting people suffering from mental ill health. It would have cost us money, but nothing is more important than a young person's life."
"Or a prominent man's reputation." He hadn't threatened to make your relationship to the Luke Wallace case public in order to get the trust to change its policy? No. Pryor returned to his seat. He wasn't that sort of man, Inspector. Not the sort to stoop to blackmail. We fell out on a number of occasions, but I admired his principles and his courage. At that last meeting, Venn said, did Dr. Yeo mention the possibility that Alexander Mackenzie had accessed a website promoting and encouraging suicide? No. Pryor seemed shocked by the suggestion. That was never mentioned on any of the occasions when we met, and it didn't appear in any of Dr. Joshi's notes. How well did you know Wesley Curnow? The change in tack threw Pryor for a moment. Not well at all. He was an acquaintance of my wife's. But he came to the house at times. Pryor shrugged. My wife's a sociable woman. She works for a number of charitable organizations and hosts many fundraising events. People come to the house all the time. He seemed to feel the need to explain. We're not the sort of couple who lives in each other's pockets. We live our own lives. It means we have something to say to each other when we finally get together. Venn wondered if the man was protesting too much, if Pryor had felt belittled by his wife's choice of friends, but he didn't push the point. There was a minute of silence. Matthew was wondering what this conversation had achieved. He'd gained no new information. But he thought he did have a greater understanding now of this man. Powerful, used to authority, but stressed and with the potential to crack and splinter under the slightest further pressure. Pryor had regained a little of his poise, his dignity. Perhaps he realized that Venn was less of a threat than he'd first thought. He pushed himself to his feet. If there's nothing else, Inspector, I'll see you out. Matthew nodded and followed him to the front door. Outside, the air was still, and there was the smell of a barbecue in a neighboring garden. The team was gathered in the ops room when he got back to the station, waiting for the evening's briefing. They shared their experiences of the day. Ross described his conversation with Cynthia Pryor. You really think she didn't have any romantic feelings for Wesley Curnow? It was, as she said, a friendship of convenience. Venn was close to few people outside work. In contrast, Jonathan seemed to have hundreds of friends, people he greeted with joy and hugs and invited to their house for supper and drinks. He opened his arms and let them into their lives. Yeah, I do. She hardly seemed devastated by his death. You know her, Jen, Matthew said. Does that sound right to you? Jen nodded. You've met Roger, uptight and wedded to the job, not an arty bone in his body. She needed someone who could share her interests. Really, I don't think there was any more to it than that. I've just come from their house, Venn said. I was summoned by Mr. Pryor. What did he want? Venn thought about that. Honestly, I'm not sure. To find out what we know, to lay down a marker? He's certainly stressed, but that's understandable after the press he got following the Wallace case. It doesn't mean he's a killer. He went on to describe his visit to Spennacott and the old people's home. So, we have another connection between Yeo and Francis Lay. Can't see how Nigel Yeo's investigation into the closure of the mount can be relevant to the investigation, but we do need to know where he went on Friday afternoon. Matthew looked around the room and saw that they were all as tired as he was. It would be fruitless to rake over the points of the case again. At this moment, all he wanted was to be at home, with Jonathan in their house by the shore. A life that was simple and less fraught was overwhelmingly tempting. Let's call it a day. Come back tomorrow with fresh ideas. We're exhausted, and there's a danger that we'll just go around in circles. The light had almost gone when he drove past Braunton Great Marsh and through the toll gate towards Crow Point. There was a red blur on the horizon where the sun was setting, so the gulls and the egrets, disturbed into the air by the sound of his car, were flushed rose. Perhaps because he'd been thinking of friendship, he had a fear, driving to the house, that Jonathan might have friends there. He pictured the house lit up, people spilling out onto the terrace with drinks, but as he approached, he saw that the only vehicle on the drive belonged to Jonathan. He'd been gearing himself up to be pleasant, to put on a show, and was flooded with relief. There was a light on in the kitchen, and he saw his husband, sharp and clear, putting a pan into the oven. He was holding it with a bright yellow folded tea towel, and his feet were bare. Matthew opened the French doors from the terrace and went in. Jonathan turned and smiled.
I heard the car. I thought you'd be starving. I made a veggie shepherd's pie.
Could it wait for a while? I wondered about a walk into the marsh. There's still enough light.
Sure, why not? I'll just turn the oven down. I'll be ready when we get back.
Everything for Jonathan was that easy. They took the track inland away from the shore and along towards the toll gate. When they came to the marsh, they stopped and looked out. There was the silhouette of a heron, tall and stately, dark grey against the paler grey of the water. It stood quite alone. I'm sorry I blundered into your investigation. Jonathan was leaning against a fence that was pockmarked with lichen. I should have been more careful.
You were just thinking about Eve.
Jonathan nodded towards the heron.
Those birds always remind me of you. So patient, just willing to wait, entirely focused on their prey.
A pause.
I wish I could be more like that. But I jump in, all splash and noise.
I've never heard one call, Matthew said.
That's like you too, then. Silent. I'm never quite sure what you're thinking.
Matthew didn't know what to say. He wanted to tell Jonathan that he loved him just the way he was, but it would have sounded trite. And even now, he wasn't entirely sure that was true. He linked his arm through Jonathan's. By the time they got home, all the colour was gone, and the only light came from the moon.